Welcome to the second Warships pod about the Ukraine crisis, in which I will discuss naval happenings or other aspects of what's been unfolding with James Bosbotanis, who has written regularly for Warships IFR magazine and is an authority on Russian weapon systems strategy and how the Russians do their business. Welcome, James.
Good afternoon, Ian. It's a pleasure to be joining you again.
And the big thing today, on the day we're recording, is the likelihood of the Russian Navy firing off some missiles and also some gunnery to the southwest of Ireland. And it's made quite a few headlines. And also there have been some maritime aircraft flying near the UK. So is this something that you would say is unprecedented? Are we returning to Cold War levels, do you think?
It's not unprecedented. The current surface action group that's deployed for these exercises is a Slava-class cruiser, one of their new Gorshkov-class frigates, and an Udaloy-class destroyer with a couple of Steraguschi-class corvettes. There's probably a submarine in there as well. And they'll be joined, as they were yesterday, by Russian long-range aviation. But it's not the first time they've done this. Back in January 2008, for example, they held a major exercise in the North Atlantic, which had the Kuznetsov, a Slava-class cruiser, a couple of Udaloys, and that was joined by Bears conducting simulated strikes on a notional opposing naval force with MiG-31s in support and, like yesterday, an A-50 mainstay AWACS. But it's certainly sending a signal to the West that Russia is proactive. It's signalling its resolve to, in their eyes, defend their security interests and show that they can project power into the North Atlantic. And certainly a Russian surface action group off the southwest coast of Ireland is something that would have to be figured in to any NATO planning. And as I said, one of the ships is there, is a new Gorshkov-class frigate, the Admiral Kasatanov, and it is armed with, or certainly capable of being armed with, caliber cruise missiles. What the loadout is on that ship is, of course, unknown, but it has a vertical launch system, and that could be holding in it 2,000-kilometre range caliber cruise missiles.
But is the location of the exercise somewhat different or special? Is there any particular reason why they would go down there rather than do it somewhere else further out to the northwest?
I think it's certainly sending a message. There has been some speculation that it could be tied into undersea cables, and that could be a factor. Russia certainly possesses an extremely capable undersea warfare capability. It could be proximity to the United Kingdom, sending the message that we can directly threaten a key NATO member and put ourselves in a position where we can cause a nuisance. It could be that it's simply the quickest area that they could get ships from the Northern Fleet and the Baltic Fleet to stage an exercise at the notice they had given.
The thing that interests me about the corvettes and, of course, the frigate, the Kasatanov, is the equipment they have in terms of the caliber missile. And although they're small vessels, the corvettes are well armed. So is the caliber something that they would ever dream of firing from a box like the one to the southwest of Ireland in the direction of Ukraine? It sounds ludicrous, but what would be the point of that? They wouldn't do that, would they? I mean, that's something that's been speculated upon and we mentioned on the last podcast, but surely the whole technical side of firing a sea-launched cruise missile like that all the way from there would be too complicated. And also, it's out of range. I know there's a new one coming in, a new weapon, a new caliber version coming in. So is any speculation and alarm about them actually doing something live in terms of targeting Ukraine at some stage from somewhere like that? Is that at all credible, do you think?
I don't think so, no. The caliber in its land attack form has a range of about 2,000 to 2,500 kilometres. So even Western Ukraine would be out of range. Of course, it would be a threat if they were deciding to prosecute targets within Europe as part of a wider campaign, in which case providing strikes from different axes would be an expected part of the Russian war plan. In terms of the new caliber you allude to, yes, the Caliber M is a larger, heavier weight derivative of the missile with more than double the range of 4,500 kilometres and a one-ton warhead. But it's not due to emerge till the middle of this decade at least. And as far has been publicly reported, it's not yet been tested or even built. Whether it actually ever appears, you know, can always be questioned with the Russians when they announce a new system. There is one thing worth noting on the long-range cruise missile front, and that is that the air-launched X-101, carried by their Bears and Blackjack strategic bombers, and has a range of about 4,500 km. A naval version was reported over 10 years ago to equip the Yassin-class hunter-killer submarine. It's never been confirmed, and whether it actually even exists is subject to debate. But if it does exist, then it could conceivably be launched from a location in the Atlantic and theoretically be capable of hitting Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking theoretical here because I don't think anybody imagines that anything that's going on to the southwest of Arnhem is going to be involving targeting any NATO nation. It's just a curious place to put it. And it's also, I would say, a very obvious and prominent display of Russia's cutting-edge long-range missiles, and they'll be fired out into a safe area in the Atlantic. And at the moment, I know there's at least the USS Roosevelt and the British destroyer Dragon out there monitoring what's going on. There'll be others as well. And so I guess we're just basically considering the characteristics of those new vessels or those new weapons. And so when you talk about the hunter-killer submarine, the Yasin, it is very interesting that they may have one of those with the group, and whether or not they fire that new missile or not. So the thing about maritime forces is, of course, they can change location and they can go somewhere else. And the big story in the past week was about the Irish fisherman who had been to meet the ambassador, the Russian ambassador in Dublin, with, I believe, some fresh prawns to entice him to move the location of the test firing out of a box in the Irish EEZ. And it was suggested that he was persuaded, probably due to common sense and it being good PR, just to move or ask the Russian Navy to move the firing further out and away from the EEZ. And maybe he was reminded of the Dogger Bank incident in 1904, when a Russian fleet on its way from the Baltic to get revenge on the Japanese for taking the Manchurian port of Port Arthur during the Russo-Japanese War, actually attacked a fishing fleet off the Dogger Bank in the North Sea that came from Hull and sank a ship and killed some people. So I guess there are some unpleasant and uncomfortable historical precedents, if anybody can remember them in the past. But this one was resolved very peacefully and via the medium of some seafood that I'm sure the ambassador enjoyed cooking up in his wok or wherever he did it. And so was that something that you feel was easy for Russia to concede, to say, well, okay, Tavarish, we'll move these missile firings out a bit? Or would it have been planned intricately months and years in advance? Would they be at all inconvenienced by that, do you think?
No, I think it was an easy PR win for them. And it fits in with their narrative that they are doing everything diplomatically and by the book. Ireland being a neutral country, they expressed their concern diplomatically. They addressed it to Russia in a pleasant manner. And of course, Russia cooperated in the spirit of friendship.
The thing that occurs to me, and I think has been an enduring feature in recent years, is the move at sea from, let's say, a bit of amity, of open cooperation, and even a bit of friendliness and cooperation in some exercises between the Russians and the West. I'm thinking of Fruchus, which you might like to tell us about in a second, but that's one thing where Russia and Western nations at the end of the Cold War got together to diffuse things and make sure there were understandings on both sides. But we're now returning, it seems to me, to an era of confrontation, or shall we say rivalry at sea. And it can be quite a tricky thing with warships carrying powerful weaponry to be in close company, can't it? I mean, we've got to be very careful out there. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. And of course, Fracas, or France, Russia, UK, US, was a confidence-building measure developed after the end of the Cold War to familiarise the three leading Western navies with the Russian Navy and build confidence between them, and as part of the post-Cold War thawing in relations. But since the ascendancy of Putin to the Kremlin, Russia has, of course, taken a more hardline turn. Thankfully, not as hardline as perhaps others would have taken it. And reflecting Russia's deep dissatisfaction with how the Cold War ended, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Putin, you know, has alluded to these in his example, 2007 Munich speech, where he spoke out against the United States and its pursuit of global hegemony as he saw it, and their actions in Georgia in 2008 and in Ukraine since 2014. And part of this has been at sea, with an increased Russian return to naval deployments, including sending, for example, ships out to the Caribbean as a strong message to the United States that, well, if you send ships to our backyard, we can send ships to Cuba again, or to Venezuela. And of course, in the Eastern Mediterranean, where the Russians, of course, strengthened their military presence in Syria in recent years and very forcefully defended their interests in Syria, particularly in 2018, where the Russians threatened serious consequences if the West undertook large-scale strikes on Assad in response to his use of chemical weapons. And the Navy has gone back to shadowing Western ships, sending the submarines out. And there is always the potential that there could be an accident or a misunderstanding. And certainly under the current circumstances, you know, you'd have to be very wary of any Russian ship that is shadowing a Western naval unit or a task group in case of any miscalculation or error of judgment, especially in the more confined seas, for example, of the Baltic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing for me is that the naval element of the Ukraine crisis, although it may not be officially linked in terms of what the Russians are doing with their navy, is quite expansive and, in fact, is global. So at the same time as we've got the troops gathering on the borders of Ukraine, we've had the frigate Admiral Gorshkov, which has been taking part in what the Russians call an expeditionary group exercise in the Barents, and that's been up in the Arctic. And then in the Baltic, there have been, according to the Russians, 20 warships, boats and support vessels taking part in training all at the same time. And also in the Pacific and in the Arabian Sea, there's also been an exercise called Peaceful Sea 2022. And there is talk that the Variag is coming up through the Suez Canal and is going to enter the Eastern Mediterranean to shadow, probably, the US Navy carrier strike group led by the Harry S. Truman there at the moment. And so it is reminiscent of the kind of global ambitions that the Russians had. And of course, there have been exercises in the Black Sea as well, where they would do a massive exercise that tried to link in various flotillas from their fleets, which are based around the globe. And those were called ocean exercises, and they happened in the 70s. And were quite a shock to NATO. I mean, they were much bigger than what we see today, much more complex, and involved simultaneous strikes globally on NATO and Western targets at the push of a button, according to the Russian Navy. So are we seeing, would you say, a real rebirth of Russian global naval presence and capability using new platforms, new ships, and other technologies that have been created since the end of the Cold War? And is it something they can sustain, or is this just a thing they'll be able to do for a few weeks while Putin needs a bit of naval pressure at sea to help the Ukraine cause that Russia has?
The ambition has certainly been there for well over a decade for the Russian Navy to return to a global presence and show the flag across the world's oceans in a neo-Gorshkovian manner. This surge in Russian naval activity, though, is notable. It is something that hasn't been seen in years, and sending all these ships out to sea, and it must be the majority of the Russian Navy's active and operational vessels, is very noteworthy, and I'm not sure how sustainable it is. And I mean, you alluded to the deployment of the Pacific Fleet's Variag with an accompanying Udaloy class destroyer, and they are due to enter the Eastern Mediterranean. And the Russian media reports that they may be joined by the Northern Fleet task group that's off Ireland, along with six amphibious warships, and form a combined naval grouping in the Eastern Mediterranean. But the ability of Russia to sustain a long-term global presence remains limited. The core of the Russian Navy is still its major surface combatants left over from the Soviet Union. Yes, they are now building the Gorshkov-class frigates and getting them into service, but they're in very limited numbers. They haven't yet even started construction of a new class of destroyer. They've been talking about it for over a decade, but they still haven't cut any steel. And their carrier Kuznetsov is, how can we put it, in a less than ideal operating condition.
At the end of its life, really, at the end of the life of that ship.
And Peter the Great doesn't seem to be moving too much. She was involved in an exercise off Severomorsk a few days ago, but whether she's actually capable of deploying out into, say, the Atlantic is debatable.
That's the nuclear-powered battlecruiser, if you like.
Yes.
She was completed post-Cold War, because when I was in St. Petersburg in 1995, I actually managed to see the top of her as she was being built. And I talked to a representative on the local council about their shipbuilding and how it was basically in a state of collapse and how lots of jobs were based on it. But I digress there. But the Nakhimov is similar to the Peter the Great.
The Admiral Nakhimov is one of Peter the Great's sister ships, one of these 25,000-ton nuclear-powered guided missile battlecruisers. And she's undergoing a comprehensive modernization and centered on the replacement of its main armament of 20 heavyweight SSN-19 shipwreck anti-ship missiles, these large Cold War-era weapons designed to kill American aircraft carriers. They're being replaced by the same vertical launch system as used on the Gorshkov class, which will hold, instead of 20 heavyweight anti-ship missiles, up to 80 caliber Veronic supersonic anti-ship missile, and the Sircon hypersonic cruise missile, which the Admiral Gorshkov, that you mentioned earlier, has been involved in the testing of, as well as the Severodvinsk, another Yasin-class submarine. So the Admiral Nakhimov is it's out of action. It is in the dock being refitted, and not due to, I think, commence sea trials next year. It is very fortunate the Admiral Nakhimov is not available to Russia at this time. It would be a very potent addition to the Russian Navy's active strength, and would be a source of considerable unease if it were in the Eastern Mediterranean or in the North Atlantic.
And a very interesting class of vessels. But as you say, thankfully, that one is not able to be at sea at the moment. I know they've been trying to modernise it for a long time. But for me, the vessels to watch, and I thought this was interesting to see earlier on in the week when we saw the corvettes coming out from the Baltic, were those small ships. So using your expertise, because you know about all the capabilities of these vessels and what they can do and can't do, it's fascinating how the Russian Navy has poured resources into doing what it can, not necessarily the most perfect thing that it needs. So, you know, following that maxim of Admiral Gorshkov, who was the famous admiral who led the Soviet Navy during the latter part of the Cold War, who said, what is it? Better is the enemy of good enough. So they've created corvettes with these land attack cruise missiles, not huge numbers of them, and also diesel electric submarines, improved Kila class submarines. I think they're building 12, or they have built 12, six in the Black Sea, six with the Northern Fleet, that can also fire cruise missiles. But they're not the nuclear powered attack submarines of the West. They're the easier to create for the Russians, diesel electric submarines, an improved version of the already well tried and tested Kilo, and the new corvettes, which are small surface combatants, but have this punch. And they've used both of those in anger, as we referred to in, I think, the previous podcast episode, against targets in Syria. So although, as you say, there's a legacy of Soviet hardware at the high end that's getting old and being refitted, and they're maybe having problems doing it, as they are with the Nakhimov and the Peter the Great sort of staggering on, and the Kuznetsov carrier has reached the end of days. The thing that I find remarkable is the mix of the less ambitious but very effective, shall we say, submarines and the corvettes. So would you say that's a real ace in the pack for the Russians, in that what they can do with those, even with a few silos of missiles? What do you think?
Absolutely, yes. And it's ironic that the Russian Navy, through its successful integration of the caliber into vertical launch systems on these even sub-1,000-ton corvettes like the Buyan-M class, they might actually have ironically undermined their own arguments for investment in the bigger surface combatants that they were planning over the past 10 years. But it has been an excellent example of adaptation to the context you are confronted with. And Russia had a glacial shipbuilding industry that simply was not turning out new ships at anything near the rate it needed to. And they turned to turning out corvettes and light frigates with the UKSK vertical launch system that they had developed, which can hold multiple types of anti-ship and land attack weapons, most famously the Calibre. And they are producing these, and they're deploying them principally in the Black Sea fleet, the Caspian flotilla, the Baltic fleet, and the Pacific fleet. And particularly in Europe, you've got these small corvettes and light frigates that can undertake strategic strikes over a range in excess of 1,000 miles, operating from Russian coastal waters. So under protective umbrella of Russian air and land-based missile forces. And it's provided an excellent capability. And they've used them in Syria, firing cruise missiles out from the Caspian flotilla, striking targets in Syria. The improved Kilo class, they built a batch of 6 of the Black Sea Fleet, transforming the Black Sea Fleet submarine force, which had fallen to just one old Kilo class boat. Now it's got this core of 6 improved caliber-armed kilos. They're building another batch of 6 for the Pacific Fleet. A batch may be built for the Baltic Fleet. And it provides, again, these very quiet, stealthy diesel-electric subs, which would be a major challenge to hunt and destroy in the littoral, with a long-range strike capability that in the West is restricted to the nuclear-powered attack subs of the Royal Navy and the US Navy with Tomahawk. And it's a great example of providing a very good capability at a pretty affordable price. And it's something that would pose a particular challenge to NATO in the event of any conflict. You know, that the Russians can operate from the Baltic and the Black Sea under robust air and missile cover from their own land forces, and be able to, for example, lob a cruise missile at targets across Europe or the UK.
And so would you say that that's actually the key to what's really going on here, is the fact that if there was really going to be some kind of serious move against the West and imminently against Ukraine, actually the warships of the Russian Navy wouldn't deploy far away. They wouldn't leave the Baltic, for example, these corvettes to go way out to the southwest of Ireland. And I suppose going back to the main theatre, the Black Sea and Eastern Med, they wouldn't leave the Black Sea. They would stay close to home, as you've suggested, in the littoral waters, the waters close to the shore. And so if there was a serious move imminent against NATO, which I don't think anybody thinks is going to happen, but if there was against Ukraine, you would actually not see loads of warships going out far away from Russia. You'd have to watch the waters close to the Crimea, close to the Russian coast, close to the Ukrainian coast, where corvettes may be operating close to their bases and the submarines are out there lurking somewhere. And that really is, I guess, a case of this much discussed, certainly on this podcast series, tactic of Maskarovka, i.e. distraction in a way. In if you're watching the frigate and the cruiser off Ireland, and you're looking into the Eastern Mediterranean where the Variag and other vessels are coming up to shadow the Harry S. Truman, that's a distraction from where the real firepower that they've created in the past few years will be and will be active from, if it's going to be used, because it can then fire straight into the Ukraine. Would you say that's a feature of what we're seeing here in this crisis?
No, I think with Ukraine, because Ukraine is obviously on Russia's border, the bulk of any long-range missile campaign against Ukraine would be from their bomber forces, which can generate very high sortie rates because, given the range of Russia's air-launched cruise missiles, the bombers wouldn't have to fly very far from their home bases, so it would be a case of take off, launch, recover, rearm. For sea-based cruise missile strikes into Ukraine, it'd come from, for example, the Caspian and some of the corvettes of the Black Sea Fleet, which remain in the Black Sea, plus the detached units operating from Syria. But in the event of a large-scale Russian assault on Ukraine, even though it is most unlikely Russia will seek a clash with NATO or NATO will intervene, the possibility has to be hedged against. And having, for example, the combined Northern Fleet, Baltic Fleet Surface Action Group of Ireland, the force in the Eastern Mediterranean there shadowing the Harry S. Truman, and covering any potential decision to deploy a force through the Bosphorus into the Black Sea. Russian naval forces in Syria provide that outer defensive layer in the Eastern Mediterranean before anything deployed to the Black Sea and could threaten Russian forces operating directly against Ukraine. And of course, having ships out in the North Atlantic, the Eastern Med, the North Sea, the Baltic, it provides Russia with other options. It spreads NATO ISR assets around so they can't all be focused on what the Russians are doing in Ukraine or Belarus. So it is Maskarovka, it's hedging, it's diplomatic signaling, it's showing that, look, if you think you can challenge us, you know, if you send arms to Poland to funnel into Ukraine, we can respond, we can do things. We're not just limited to operating in the Black Sea or the Baltic or from Russian homeland itself. You know, we can interdict stuff out in the North Atlantic, we can do the big anti-convoy operations or disrupt whatever you're planning to do. And increasingly, with the long-range cruise missile forces that they've deployed, and the US has stated this, Russia can also now take the fight to its adversaries' homelands if necessary. It has now a much greater capability than it did in the past, and one that will only grow through this decade, to be able to threaten even the continental United States with a conventional cruise missile attack. But it is a case with Ukraine, they want to be able to signal that they have that defense in depth, that they have options, and that if NATO doesn't take Russia's security interests seriously, and Ukraine is part and parcel of it, but it goes beyond Ukraine, that Russia can and will defend its interests.
Yeah, and the talking of convoys and signalling and all the rest of it, the six amphibious vessels that have been put together from the Northern Fleet and the Baltic Fleet, which have joined up in the North Sea, I think, 10 days ago, whatever it was, and have sailed down through the Straits of Gibraltar and are crossing the Mediterranean now, they represent probably, along with the Black Sea Fleet, whatever they've got in terms of amphibious warfare vessels, that represents the entirety at the moment of the amphibious assault ships of the Russian Navy, of Russia. So they are going to arrive in the same part of the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean. They will arrive and be met by the action group sent up from through Suez and other vessels that will then provide cover for those ships, which I'm sure don't have troops on board at the moment. They probably have equipment. They have some troops on board, but they're not ready to go for an invasion. And they could go through the Turkish Straits and into the Black Sea. So that's a key element, isn't it, of the signalling, of the having options if Russia wants to do something. And we don't know if it's a distraction from other things or if they really will go through and then head to Sevastopol or Novorossiysk or Erevan and pick up more equipment and troops and then mount an amphibious assault on, let's say, probably not could be Odessa, but more likely to go into the Sea of Azov and then attack or launch an invasion of Mariupol. So that's a whole side to this that we haven't discussed as yet here. But that is something that's worth keeping an eye on as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. The Black Sea Fleet has been doing a lot of training on amphibious operations in recent years. The Russians used their amphibious assets in the war against Georgia in 2008. There has been a lot of debate on whether they would attempt an amphibious landing around Odessa. I would say it is a potential contingency. I suppose it depends very much on what else Russia was considering, whether it would be a part of some multiple Axis assault on Ukraine, taking in forces, moving in the Sea of Azov, as well as from the east and the north now with their Russian presence in Belarus, or whether, and this would perhaps be a more likely scenario, as in the US Marine Force in Operation Desert Storm, poised at sea sitting there going to the Iraqis, look at us, here we are, we're going to land on Kuwait's beaches soon, and you're going to have to fight us. You keep an opposing force tied down, having to defend a stretch of coastline from the threat of invasion, whilst you go around and take the force from other directions. And those six ships, one of them is the Pyotr Morgunov, one of Russia's two new Ivan Gren landing ships. Those six ships, they could carry around 1,500, 1,800 men between them, plus a good load of armoured vehicles or tanks. The Russians have to factor in the possibility that Ukrainian anti-ship missile batteries, for example, would get lucky. And I think the Russian Navy would want to be very careful. President Putin supports Russia's maritime ambitions. He supports the Navy. He probably would not be very happy with his admirals if they suggested an opposed landing, which went wrong, and a good chunk of Russia's amphibious warfare assets were sent to the bottom of the Black Sea.
Yeah, that would be horrendous in all sorts of ways for Russia, and in fact, in general, you know, to see that happening because of some miscalculation, vessels burning off ashore. I mean, it's the 40th anniversary year of the Falklands conflict, and the UK learned to its bitter cost what happens when amphibious vessels get in a vulnerable position and perhaps don't have the protection they need, or the troops are aboard them longer than they should be. So that was an episode in the Falklands War where Argentinian jets bombed a landing ship similar to the ones that we see the Russians sending across the Mediterranean at the moment. So you're right, Vladimir Putin, President Putin will be very wary of that. I'm sure the Russian commanders will be as well. But turning to NATO, the NATO response, which has been pretty comprehensive from the Arctic down through into the Mediterranean and even in the Black Sea. I mean, what do you think to the NATO response? Has it stepped up to the plate at sea to keep an eye on the Russians and to keep tabs on them and be a deterrent, do you think?
I think so, yes. Certainly assigning the Harry S. Truman strike group to NATO command for the first time since the Cold War was a very strong signal from the United States. And the exercise is due to be held next month, which will see the Harry S. Truman and Britain's HMS Prince of Wales sail north, is a very tangible demonstration to the Russians and a very potent reminder that at sea, NATO holds a decisive edge. And so far, NATO's response has been measured and proportionate. Certainly, if the crisis continues to deteriorate and the United States, for example, decides to move more naval assets to the region, the concern that could itself trigger escalation could materialise. But at the same time, NATO's advantage at sea provides a credible threat to Russia. For example, in the Cold War, particularly in the 1980s, the US pursued its forward maritime strategy, focusing on the Norwegian Sea, sending carrier battle groups to threaten the Soviet forces on the Kola Peninsula. That caused a great deal of alarm in Moscow. And if you want to look to counter Russian forces and movements in Belarus, in Ukraine, where they had the edge by virtue of their superior deployed land power, NATO has the asymmetric edge and can threaten the Russians at sea, and certainly threatening the, although it is a very potent force, the Northern Fleet is a much diminished force compared to what it was in the Cold War, but it's very, very sensitive due to its role as holding the bulk of a Russian naval strategic nuclear deterrent. If you want to get Moscow's attention, sending a couple of British and American aircraft carriers up to Northern waters, as well as strengthening NATO's ally there, Norway, and the allies with Finland and Sweden, although, of course, Finland and Sweden are not formal allies, they're not members of NATO. It sends Moscow a strong message. And going forward, if, for example, we are confronted by the worst case scenario over the coming months of Russia managing to reintegrate Ukraine or a substantial portion of it, plus Belarus, into some form of union or whatever it wants to call it, NATO will have to respond. And a key part of that will be responding at sea, strengthening NATO's deterrent posture to show Russia that its land grabs, its reconstituted mini Soviet Union or whatever it wants to call it, can and will be countered, that if Russia thinks that it can unilaterally redraw land boundaries in Europe or make demands of NATO to go back to 1997 force postures or threaten Sweden or Finland in the Baltic, or Norway, for example, over the Svalbard archipelago, NATO maritime power can be brought to bear as part of its wider capabilities to deter whatever Russia can do. And the Russians know that at sea, they would be at a marked disadvantage, bar their submarine forces. But there again, to counter the threat posed by Russian submarines, it's going to be naval-led to make sure that any submarine threat is detected and tracked, and if the worst ever came to the worst, could be rapidly contained.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that was the policy, the forward defence, certainly the policy with the submarine forces of the UK, of NATO, was to push forward up around the north of Norway into the Barents Sea and the Greenland Sea, the Norwegian Sea, put submarines up there, give the Russians something to think about, as you said, with the carriers. And I think that's the problem I see at the moment we have with Russia, is that the Russians are being allowed to set their own terms to dictate where they do things, because obviously the democracies thought at the end of the Cold War, thank goodness that's over, we can disarm, we can reap the peace dividend. And of course, naval forces have been neglected, I would say more, well, were neglected more than other forces during the period of the wars post 9/11. And that has ended now. And of course, it takes a long time to build a navy back up, to build an anti-submarine capability backup, to create the new platforms and the new capabilities, whether they're drones or in actual warships that launch the drones. And that's where I think the Russians, in my view, have an edge. And they do have an edge in terms, if you look just at the Royal Navy, in terms of sheer firepower, in terms of platforms and sort of things they've invested in. The Royal Navy is very much underarmed. And it's a problem we highlight in the next edition of the magazine, which we discuss of how can we solve that, and that's got to be addressed. But you're right, it's about using the navies, and we mustn't forget that something like the USS Harry S. Truman Carrier Strike Group is composed of not just that carrier with those jets, and we're not thinking just in terms of jets. We're thinking in terms of Ticonderoga class cruiser and Arleigh Burke class destroyers, and they have dozens of land attack cruise missiles, and also a submarine or two submarines will be assigned again with land attack cruise missiles. So in terms of conventional deterrent, the Harry S. Truman strike group has that, and that's how, because as you say, those missiles can strike up to 1,000 miles inland. They're also formidable vessels in themselves, and then if you move through the Mediterranean back out into the Atlantic and up to the UK's area and that of other Northwest European NATO nations, the firepower and the heavy metal does decline, but it's still there, as you say. There's still an edge in quality, but it's just numbers, and I would say offensive firepower is lacking. And also a strategy, this idea that you've got the Russians in Ukraine, and they're in the, you know, in the center of the landmass or the surrounding Ukraine. And okay, one thing to do is to send some paratroopers to the Baltic states from the UK, and to send a striker brigade to other NATO East European nations to hold the line. But if you want to really make the Russians think, and Vladimir Putin does very much believe in keeping Russia's access to the sea open and using his navy to gain power and influence, then you should press, as you say, I agree, on that maritime flank, on all the maritime flanks, and give them something to do up in the north or elsewhere in the Pacific, instead of sending their vessels down to the southwest of Ireland or getting busy in the eastern Mediterranean. And I think NATO, if it got its act together in the next few years, and God forbid there should be a war before then, let's hope we can deter them that long and they don't make any rash moves, then I'm sure, as you say, NATO could be ascendant as it was in the Cold War, and then set the pace and do things on its terms, instead of letting the Russians, who have a massive army and massive amounts of tanks, set the pace and do things on their terms. I think that's the main thing that I see as wrong at the moment with the West leaders, is playing catch up and not really grabbing, you know, the rose by the thorns, or the whatever you want to say about it, but not really grappling with the issue. And that means, you know, more naval firepower, more navies, more presence, more investment, and a bigger effort. And you get, you know, I see it on Twitter, and I've experienced it myself on social media. People say, oh, but we can't do that. We can't. How are we going to do that? Well, the truth is, a bit like the Battle of the Atlantic in World War II, you have to do it. And the scale of what you do is vast. And if you want to avoid a confrontation and a terrible war that's as vast and horrible as a world war on the Battle of the Atlantic, you have to make some effort, and a greater effort now. Now, I've digressed there, but that's the way I see it. I mean, there's been talk about this being a new Battle of the Atlantic carrying on, and it's the West that hasn't woken up to it, but certain admirals have and have been warning about it for years. So I think we need to grapple with that maritime side of it. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the editor of a naval magazine.
Absolutely. If you think in 1990, the UK spent around 4% of GDP on defence. Now we spend around 2%. And yes, there are many, many claims to, for example, in the UK's context, government spending resources. There's the National Health Service, there's the response to coronavirus, etc. But a failure of Western deterrence and Putin believing that, well, just to you know, go set the scene. Say, for example, he does decide this year he resolves Ukraine on his terms, and he does that, and he's got now a de facto occupation of Belarus, with the US suggesting 30,000 Russian troops in Belarus. Belarus and Ukraine being back in the Russian fold gives Russia a transformed position in Eastern Europe, but still, the Kremlin wants that agreement from the West that NATO will go back to where it was in 1997, what they have called for in this new European security architecture. And in 5 years' time, Putin or a successor decides, I took Ukraine, I got Belarus back in the fold. It is time now to lay down the law to the West. And instead of talking about a Russian invasion of Ukraine, we are talking about a Russian invasion of Poland, member of NATO, one that NATO would have to look to defend. And the scale of effort required to deter, let alone to defend or counter a Russian invasion of Poland would be immense. You'd be looking at something in scale not seen since a desert storm in 1990-1991, but happening in Central and Eastern Europe. The cost of that and the consequences of war with Russia, let alone leaving aside the possibility that war with Russia could ultimately lead to nuclear escalation, the cost of a conventional limited war with Russia would far outweigh the costs to the exchequer of an increase in defence spending. And ultimately, an increased defence budget is not to prepare to fight a war in several years. It's preparing and making sure that your forces are credible and your deterrent posture and your diplomacy are credible, so that that war doesn't happen. And that's what we desperately need to do. And we have, over the past 20 years, time and again, ignored the threat from Russia. Putin has not hidden his ambitions. Russia has not hidden its planned military modernization efforts. They've been crystal clear about it. And Putin has said in 2007, he sent his troops into Georgia in 2008, and they annexed Crimea in 2014 and started trying to destabilize the rest of Ukraine that year. And they sent forces to Syria in 2015. And, you know, for all the talk after the end of the Cold War, well, we'll have 10 years warning. We had 10 years warning. We had more than 10 years warning, but those warnings were not heeded. And, you know, we also had the diversions of enduring land campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we are now confronted by a situation where war in Europe is a distinct possibility. And yes, Russia might plan only for it to involve Ukraine, and the West may not plan to intervene to defend Ukraine. But wars and plans don't tend to mix very well. Accidents happen, miscalculations occur, and you know, the stakes could not be higher in this case.
Yeah, and I think the Russians have exploited, we won't get into it too much, the lack of deterrent, and I don't mean strategic deterrent. I think you and I could perhaps talk about that some other time, the nuclear side of it. But I think what the Russians have done is they have exploited the lack of conventional deterrent. So you've had the whittling away of NATO and UK and other European armed forces. You've had a great deal of the conventional deterrent whittled away over the years. I'm not saying we should maintain massive navies and massive armies of tanks, etc., etc. I would never advocate that, because you've got to be realistic. I mean, the Russians don't have, although they have a huge amount of tanks, etc., they don't have a massive armed force at sea, for example. So, I mean, things are different. It's not the same as the past, but the conventional deterrent forces of the West, of the UK and other nations, have fallen away. And so the Russians are exploiting their ability to take advantage of lack of conventional deterrent, because they know that nobody in their right mind, only a lunatic and insane person, would want to have any kind of nuclear war. So what they're doing, I think, in Ukraine is pushing it and pushing it, because they think their time is here with a lack of conventional deterrent in the West, confused and indecisive leadership in the West, a cause which they finally got their teeth into, which is to bring those nations, as you say, back into Mother Russia's embrace. So I think they see this as an opportunity to exploit that weakness in conventional deterrent and resolve. And I think they will do that as much as they can, but they're also masters of not pushing it too far. So I think this crisis now is the real final warning, I think, as you say, to us. I mean, we can't imagine why Russia or anybody would want to use massive tank formations or invade a country in Europe. We don't really understand it. But I think you need to understand things from the Russian point of view, look at the world from Moscow's point of view, and the same would be true of the Chinese from Beijing's point of view, and understand they are working to a certain set of rules and ambitions, and the West is following its own course. But at the moment, the totalitarians, the non-democracies, the hybrid former communist states are actually setting the pace. And I think we do need to worry about it now and do something about it and not keep putting it off. I mean, procurement in the UK and naval programs and everything are sluggish, and they take forever to actually come to a conclusion, produce fighting capabilities and warships and submarines. And that needs to end, because I think we underestimate the Russians at our peril, particularly when we've still got North Korea to worry about with its pursuit of nuclear weapons, the Iranians, who would dearly love to have nuclear weapons as well, and of course China, which is seeking to make sure that certain international waters in the South China Sea are its own and that it controls them. And they have ambitions to come over the top and exert themselves as a maritime power in the Atlantic as well and around the world. So I think there's a whole lot of things on the agenda that we need to grapple with. And so I think we do underestimate all those things at our peril. Is that something you agree with, that we've got a whole range of things we need to grapple with that we're not really addressing?
Absolutely, yes. You know, I think we in the West had a nice period in the 1990s and up to 9/11, thinking that, in academia, it was called the end of history. But we do face now a multitude of challenges to Western preeminence. There are countries either emerging or re-emerging that want to take up their place at the top table again. There are regional powers that seek to attain dominance in their respective regions and counter what they perceive as unjust American-led interference in their affairs, and there are good old traditional great power rivalries re-emerging. And you know, the Cold War was perhaps something of an aberration, that bipolar confrontation between two respective blocks. You know, before that, looking back further over history, you know, there were a number of great powers with their rivalries, the requirement for adept diplomacy, for realpolitik, and we in the West need to get back to understanding history, understanding statecraft, knowing that you have to sometimes be forceful in defending your interests, and knowing that the world is an unstable place, it's a contested environment, and it's not one that can be taken lightly. It's not something that you can go, well, that belongs in the 19th or 20th centuries. We're 21st century postmodernists here, because other countries and other leaders will say, no, that's not how it works. And if you don't defend your interests, someone else will push their interests, and you will either have to accept that you have to play second place to someone else, or you have to defend what you stand for, and ultimately, if necessary, fight for it.
And I would agree with that, James. I think you're absolutely on the button with that. And I think the world does need to wake up to that and understand these are the things that we've got to tackle. Those of us that live in the West, as it's now become again, I thought that term had gone actually with history itself. But there you go. It's now West versus East, or West versus the others. So thanks for coming on to discuss that. I think we could end it there, and we'll come back to some of the other topics in future podcasts. And I really appreciate you discussing some of these very complex issues with me, and explaining to me and also the Warships Pod listeners some of the technicalities and also the strategy and the other things associated with them. So thank you very much for coming on Warships Pod.
Thank you very much, and it's been an absolute pleasure as always.
Since I spoke to James, things have developed when it comes to the naval side of the Ukraine crisis, and the landing ships that we mentioned, the six vessels, have reached Tartus in Syria, which is a naval facility that supports the Russian activities in Syria and also acts as a replenishment and refueling stop for Russian naval vessels going to the Eastern Mediterranean, whether they come from the Black Sea or the other fleets. And those six ships have been at Tartus and within hours or a day or so actually left, which was quite surprising, because I would have thought they would have stayed there for a couple of days, 3 or 4 days, maybe even a week, to replenish and get repairs and give their crews a bit of a rest. But no, they're already beginning to leave, and there are transits of the Turkish Straits booked, so I believe, for them. And they will be going through there over the next week or so. And with them, and this is a very interesting development really, is a submarine called the Rostova Nedonu. I've probably pronounced that incorrect, but it's basically called the Rostov on Don. A Kilo class submarine, as we discussed with James in the main podcast. And that was likely operating out of Tartus as well, and is also going through the Turkish Straits back into the Black Sea, and armed with those caliber missiles that we discussed, will be useful for whatever contingencies the Russians need them. Also expected in the Eastern Mediterranean, and possibly already there, are the ships Variag, a Slava-class cruiser, which we mentioned too, and one we didn't mention called the Admiral Tribbets, which is a Udaloy anti-submarine destroyer, which would have accompanied the cruiser Variag up through the Suez Canal into the Eastern Med. And meanwhile, in more movements from the Russians, at the other end of the Mediterranean, in the western end, a fleet tanker of the Russian fleet has been spotted by one of our sources off Algeria, waiting at an anchorage where it is traditional for Russian warships to pause and make a rendezvous with such a vessel, a fleet tanker, to receive fuel, possibly other supplies, before making that long transit across to the east of the Mediterranean. And it's suspected that might be a Udaloy-class destroyer called the Vice Admiral Kulikov, which has been out in the Atlantic with the others. And so that is another anti-submarine vessel that will be sent there to the Eastern Mediterranean to either keep an eye on the Americans and other NATO navies and what they're up to, or into the Black Sea. And the interesting thing about the landing ships compared to the submarine is that I would expect, whatever the Russians decide to do, that the landing ships will go to Sevastopol and join up with those of the Black Sea Fleet, which has about a dozen similar vessels altogether, if you include landing craft and landing ships, and or go to a place called Novorossiysk on the other side of the Black Sea towards the east from Sevastopol. And those landing ships will prepare with troops that they'll pick up somewhere at a naval base in the Black Sea, and also equipment. And they'll then decide whether or not they take part in some kind of amphibious operation, or they're just there to distract NATO and be a deterrent to NATO moves and make Ukraine feel uneasy. But it's the submarine that I find interesting, in that a submarine is always prepared for any kind of action. So when that submarine goes through the Turkish Straits and then out into the Black Sea, it may well be that the vessel does not go to a base, but stays at sea and awaits orders, because they'll be ready to fire their missiles or not to fire them. So I think we should keep an eye on all the Russian movements and then weigh up what do they need to do next to prepare for whatever may or may not come. So as they say, it's interesting times and also worrying times. So things are moving apace. The naval pieces are being moved around on the chessboard, and we'll keep an eye on it and let you know what happens in the magazine, in reports on the website, and of course, discuss it in the next podcast. And you can read more about the naval side of the Ukraine crisis in the forthcoming March edition of Warships IFR, which is available digital and hard copy officially from the 18th of February. It's a mix of news, views, and also, of course, fantastic imagery. And if you want to learn more about general global naval operations, I would suggest that's the magazine for you. And thanks very much for listening to the Warships Pod. And I'm looking forward already to recording another episode sometime in the near future.